All right, well, thank you. Good morning and welcome. It is a beautiful, beautiful day today. I know that there are some young ones around, and so they have been dismissed. I'm going to keep the older ones in here, Ruth, so if you wanted to go and track them down. For those of us still here today, we're going to do something a little bit different today and next Sunday and the Sunday following. And I want to kind of center our time around Hebrews chapter 10 and verses 24 and 25. It says, we read, and let us consider. Let us consider. Let us think about. Let us meditate upon. Let us ponder how we may spur one another on. In some translations, it doesn't say spur. It says provoke. I think maybe the best word I could put in there would be to motivate. Right, to motivate toward love, toward agape in the Greek, toward seeking nothing, agape, seeking nothing but the highest good of the other, and good deeds, right? So our activity, hands and feet. Not giving up meeting together, as is the habit of some, obviously not for you, but encouraging one another. And one of the things I want us to notice from this is that in these verses is there is a very, it's saturated with this idea of community, right? I mean, we get let us consider, there's us, spur one another, motivate one another, right? Meeting together, encouraging one another, and all of that so that we may be more active in agape, in love, in seeking nothing but the highest good of the other, and in good deeds, in reaching out to others, hands and feet. And I think one of the beautiful ways that we can spur one another, one of the beautiful ways to take from that song we just sang, one of the beautiful ways that we can inspire and motivate and encourage one another is through the sharing of our stories. And so for these next three Sundays, that's exactly what we're going to enter into. And so for today, this Sunday, I'm not going to just pick anybody at random. don't worry, to come up and have a conversation. But I want to invite Teresa to come on up and share with us today. And so the way we're going to do this is just to kind of have a conversation. And as we're having that conversation, I do have some questions that I want you to maybe think about as you're listening. And so as you listen today, maybe ask yourself, what resonates with me as you hear Teresa share her story? What resonates with me? What challenges me? Maybe what inspires me? Maybe what motivates me? And so as you listen, be intentional as you enter into her story. And then with that, maybe to consider, what might I receive from Teresa's story that I might incorporate or integrate, absorb into my own journey? And then another thought, maybe just how might I move more toward love and good deeds as I listen today? How might I be moved toward more love and good deeds? And so, thank you, Teresa.
Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to this. And so I just kind of wanted to start by just some of the, I think of that, there's that old show, Just the Facts, right? Where growing up, where were you born? Siblings, parents? Were you around other family? Just kind of some of those basics.
Before we do that, I just want to start by just saying thank you for inviting me to share my story. And also just a special thanks to all of you. In the time that I've been here, I've felt so welcome and received and felt that the mission that you have is one that resonates so deeply in my heart. And so I'm just really happy to be a part of this wonderful community. So to start, where do I begin? So I was born in Los Angeles. I grew up in the home where my mother had grown up, in a working class neighborhood of people who were teachers and postal workers. It was a diverse community, primarily African-American, Japanese-American, and Black. And I did pull out some pictures from kind of my early life. You know, you see the beautiful baby there, of course. That's me. my parents were teachers, and they met while teaching at Southern University in Baton Rouge, Louisiana. And then my mom had grown up in Los Angeles, and so they came back to LA. And that, actually, the picture that's there on your right far is my mom, my dad, and my grandmother at the reception that my grandmother put on in her home and as they came back after they had been married in Louisiana.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
So, no siblings?
Oh, I don't have any siblings, no.
Okay.
I don't have any siblings, but I come from a big family. My grandmother was the kind of matriarch of our family. She had seven brothers and sisters, all of whom migrated through what we call the Western Migrant Stream. People went from the little bitty town where they came from in Cuero, Texas, to San Antonio, to El Paso, to Calexico, to San Diego, Bakersfield, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and all the way up to Weed. So everybody was just kind of on that migrant stream, getting out of Texas.
So you were in Los Angeles,
yep.
And was that the length of your childhood was in Los Angeles, or did you?
I lived in Los Angeles until I was 13. I lived in Los Angeles, and then my mom, we moved, after my father died, we moved to Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, and she was studying there, she was in graduate school there. We came back to Los Angeles, and then she got a job in Michigan, and we moved to Michigan.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So tell us a little bit about your childhood. Sounds like for at least the first 13 years you were in the same house, the house that family had been in?
Yeah. So it was, I grew up, because I was the only child, and my grandmother had my mom very late in her life, at 37, which was very late in 1929. And then my mom had me at 30. And so everybody else was older than me. All my cousins were older, so I was kind of like the baby of the entire kind of clan, like one of the youngest kids, except for now grandchildren, you know, or great-grandchildren. So I just grew up in a home that was just, people were coming there to visit all the time. My grandmother, who had just such an incredible influence on my life, I lived with her from the time my mom went back to work at 2 weeks after I was born until I was like 7 or 8 years old. So I lived with her because my parents were working, and in those days there wasn't childcare places where you could go. It was your family who took care of you. And so there were always people in our home. People came to for counsel. They came when they were in crisis. She was the person that everyone came to. And so there's just always people in our home, always people visiting, that are a very close-knit neighborhood. We knew all of our neighbors. People we either went to church with, or like one of my cousins, his teacher, all the way through primary school elementary school lived across the street, and she and my grandmother were great friends. So we just had a very tight-knit and close community.
So you really had to get good grades.
I did have to get good grades.
What?
That was not an option.
Yeah. If you're not doing your homework, they know. So what? What kinds of activities? I mean, as a young child, I'm thinking 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. Were you outdoors mostly? Indoors? Riding bikes?
Yeah. So outside, you know, my grandmother kind of was like a very, she was very strict. And one of the things that she was strict about was that children, that you couldn't go into anybody else's house, and kids couldn't come into your house from the neighborhood. So we all played outside. So we were always outside. Then we would get maybe one of the older kids. They would take us to the Rose Garden. So we lived in central Los Angeles by USC and the sports arena and the Rose Gardens and the Museum of Science and Industry is there. And so we would spend our time, we would go over to the Rose Garden, we'd go to the park, we'd ride our bikes, we'd play in the yard and do that. And then in the summers we traveled. We would go to Texas to visit family. We'd come up to Weed. Now you know where Weed is. We'd come to We come up to Wee to visit people. My grandmother was an Eastern Star, and my grandfather was a Mason. And so the Weed is the turnaround for the Southern Pacific Railroad. And so during that time, there was a large African-American community that lived there because of the lumber industry, and also because that's where the porters, their families were there, because that was the end of the line. And so they would get there, they'd spend some time at home, and then they would come back to go. So we traveled all around Arizona, El Paso, go down to El Paso, and at that time, there was really no border. There was really no border. You just drove across, you know, get in the car and drive across or walk across, and you know, all that portion of my family, that part of my family, all of those people speak Spanish. And so that's how I actually started speaking Spanish early in my life.
Nice. So you and I have talked before, and I remember you mentioned doing a lot of reading.
Yeah, that was my thing. So for me, that was probably one of my favorite activities. I was one of those kids whose parents have to, you know, come in the door and say, "I know you're under the covers with the flashlight. Turn that flashlight off. Stop reading." So I was one of those kids who always wanted to read, always loved books, and went to the library all the time, and had an Encyclopedia Britannica that my grandmother got used from somebody, and you know, I read that. And so I was just one of those kids who was always very curious and loved information.
Yeah. We have our daughter Holly. We had the whole A to Z encyclopedias, and I think she read through them all by the time she was like 7 or something. I think I might have some insight into this from what you've shared already, but who had the biggest influence on you in those younger years?
My grandmother, that lady right there in the middle. And she's in these pictures, and there's some aunts and from her family. But my grandmother, she was just an incredible person, an incredible human being. She had such a big spirit, gardening, counseling, canning. I went with her, since I lived with her, you know, I have this image of myself sitting in a chair like this, you know, but a little kid with my legs crossed going like this, somebody saying, "Now you better be still," you know, at visiting somebody, because mm-hmm. We visited the sick and shut-in every week. That was one of our activities. We did that, we went to Bible study, you know, when they were going to cook for funerals and those things, I was the person who was tagging along. So she was just a very kind and loving person.
We all need that. We all need that kind and loving person in our life. So what, I want to get to kind of faith and how in your earliest years, but before we go there, what kind of challenges did you experience growing up?
Well, I think there's a couple. I was thinking about that because you had asked me that question earlier, Cynthia. You know, what were the challenges? I actually think that overall my childhood was pretty easy. I mean, I didn't really, the challenges I faced were the challenges out, kind of out in the world. So first of all, you all can see me, and you can see my height. And so I was always very tall, taller. I was always the tallest girl in the class. You know, I was 6 feet when I was 13 years old. You know, and so I think one of the challenges that I experienced in the world was that people always thought that I was older and that I was more mature than I was. And so people would say, "Why are you acting like a child?" And I was like, "Because I am." You know. So that was just like, just in terms of how you move in the world and like being able to come into your body as a person and live in that body, you know, that can be a challenge. People have it in different ways. So that was one of the challenges. And I think probably the other biggest challenge of my childhood was that is that my father died when I was 13. And he died a very tragic death, and so that was something that took me, you know, a long time.
not something that I talk about much, but something that took me a long time to get over.
Yeah.
Obviously, it still hurts.
Yeah. Well, thank you for sharing that.
Yeah.
Thinking about, again, those early years, were you raised as part of a faith community? And if so, how did that shape you? And if not, how did that shape you?
Well, I think what I would say is that there was never a time in my life that I didn't feel the presence of God and the presence of Spirit in my life. Like, as if from my earliest memories, as if like the angels were watching over me. I just have always felt that. Everybody in the world and the orbit that I lived in and that I was raised in, there was nobody who didn't go to church. So every Sunday we went to church. We went to Bible study. My father's father was a Baptist minister in the little town of Rodessa, Louisiana, and founded the church there. My grandmother's father was a minister and founded the church where they lived in Bloomberg, Texas. So everybody, like, I didn't know anything else. And I think it wasn't until I went to college somebody asked me if I was saved. And I said, well, what does that mean? I was like, what do you mean, are you saved? Is that like something you become? You know, because for me, it just always was. I don't know how else to.
Yeah, it was the air you breathed.
It was just the air that I breathed. I didn't know anything different. How that was manifested was in the way that you lived your life, in being courteous to people, and to being kind to people, in, you know, visiting the sick and shut in. And my grandmother used to say, now, you know, every time you go out that front door, you need to put on the armor of Christ. So it just became, it was like, okay, you have to think about how you're going to move in the world, what you represent. I think that fourth Philippians, I mean, that's my quote. That's my quote of growing up. You know, this is how you are. Not even supposed to be, it's just, this is how you are.
But that Philippians passage, this was actually our responsive reading well this morning.
So to be glad in the Lord at all times. I mean, this is the way, I think this is what I would say is something that I have heard people say all of my life. And so this is how faith is. And everything comes from that belief.
Yeah. And I will tell you, I did a little digging into your experience, and I can really see how what you've shared with us now influenced you into your adult years.
Absolutely.
And you can speak about some of this, but Peace Corps in at least three different countries. You were in Kenya for 10 years with a nonprofit, I believe. You were, and maybe still are, the interim medical director in Burundi.
Not anymore, but yeah, I was.
Okay.
Yeah.
So there's that. A family physician, medical doctor, and you're also a Oregon State master
gardener.
And in our community garden back there Friday, we were picking tomatoes and for people in the food share pantry. And so when I read that, it's really touches me how that faith moved you into, and Philippians 4:9, how it moved you into your adulthood. So tell us a little bit about that kind of transition into, because it's that influence that you had from your young years, and how as you moved into young adulthood and were asked if you were saved and went on into your careers, what was that like?
So I would say that I didn't, like, from the perspective of you know, becoming a physician, what I would say is that my path was one of discovery. I started off, you know, so I have my undergraduate degree is in Latin American studies, so always interested in, so I was a Spanish speaker, always interested in other diverse communities, and I volunteered in those communities. From there, I went back to Los Angeles. We were in Michigan. I went back to Los Angeles. I stayed with my grandmother. She was aging. You know, I just saw how people would go to their doctor's appointments with her. I'd see how people were treated. I saw, you know, the people in the older people in the church and what was happening with them. We were still visiting the sick and shut in, except now I was driving. You know, instead of my grandmother taking me. And just, I think that kind of led me to think that I wanted to do something more. And I had, my minors are in chemistry and biology, so I had done the science portion of it. So I was looking for a job, and somebody said, hey, there's this phlebotomy program down at Children's Hospital of Orange County. And so I said, oh, I could do that. So I did that. And so I was a phlebotomist for a couple of years. And then I said, seeing all these people in the hospital, it was never in my orbit. There was nobody in my world who was a doctor. So I was like, oh, well, maybe I could be a nurse. And so then I went to nursing school. And I got a degree in nursing, and I practiced that for a year or two, and then I was like, I am just as smart, if not smarter, than these doctors I see. So let me just try to figure out if I can, you know, and I think I could be a better advocate for my patients than they are. And so then I applied to medical school, and I got into medical school. And then, you know, I met a wonderful mentor who started the family medicine program down in Klamath Falls through OHSU, and I came out as a medical student to do a rotation with him, and then he encouraged me to apply to OHSU to the family medicine program, and so I did that. And so all along I was, you know, doing, you know, we were doing trips like to Mexico and to an orphanage, to, you know, just doing all of this work that was all in line with, you know, how do you be of service to the community? How do you be of service to the world that you live in? And not, you know, not just talk the talk, but, you know, how does your faith and how does your belief in God and your fundamental values, how do they show up in the work that you do? And so I felt like medicine was that whole journey was just, it was like God was unfolding that for me. Like that wasn't in my intention in my mind. It's just that it was like the door would just open. An idea would come, the door would open, and you'd walk through the door. And then the next door would open, and you'd walk through that door. I didn't feel like I was really the person. I didn't feel like I was necessarily powering that on my own. You know, it was really, it was truly those angels who were, like, you know, whispering in my ear saying, you know, you need to take the next step. You know, my mom said to me when I was being encouraged to apply to medical school, I was like, you know, I'm going to be old. I'll be like 33 when I get out of medical school, you know. I mean, I'm like, you know, I'm going to be old, and she's like, or 35, and she's like, well, you're going to be 35 one way or another. And so the question is, you know, do you want to be a doctor and be 35, or do you want to be doing what you're doing and be 35? You know, so it was, you know, that kind of encouragement. And, you know, and then from there, I, again, doing rotations in different places, you know, working with the underserved. I had a great family physician who took care of us and took care of me most of my life. That was really, I loved just the entirety of what he did and the way he treated people and the relationship. And I wanted to be able to have that. And then in 1993, I had the opportunity to do an international rotation. And I ended up going to Lugulu in Kenya. And so that was my first time on the continent. And I fell in love with Kenya and fell in love with the people who were there and have spent the last 30 years going back and forth. And again, like, how does it happen? How does something develop? and manifest itself out of opportunities. I'd come back and somebody say, oh, I want to go. I was like, oh, well, you could come with me the next time. And then that grew into a rotation at Pacific University for students and, you know, teaching, and then people in the community. Oh, well, when you come back, couldn't you teach us a class? Oh, yeah, well, and recruiting nurses from Silverton Hospital and other places to come with me and do work focused on safe motherhood and delivery. And so it's just been, it really, like, literally has just been like one creation after the other, fueled by the power of the Holy Spirit.
Yeah. You know, going back to the questions I was asking, what resonates with me is that my plan was never to be a pastor.
Yes.
You know, and even when I got out of school, it was counseling psychology, and then I was approached by Phil, and we had a conversation, and then that led into coming on staff, and 25 years later.
Here you are.
Here I am.
Here you are.
So, yeah, life, I think if you're open to and kind of surrendered to the movement of the Spirit.
That's right.
Yeah.
And get out of your own way. Yeah. I mean, I think that's the part, you know, that's one of the big parts is, you know, we've talked about this, is just, you know, how do you get out of your own way? Can you, you know, when you find yourself anxious about something or angry about something or feeling, you know, like someone has wounded you or something like that, to be able to just say, you know, what's every experience in my life is instructional. What's the lesson that God is giving me in this experience? Yeah. And so that habit of self-reflection and self-inquiry is, I think, really what centers me in my life and helps me to just kind of stay so that I'm not swept to one side or swept to the other side by things that are happening in the world or some interpersonal thing that happens. But, you know, how do you put on that armor, you know, and wear that armor in your life as you take every step through your day?
Yeah. So you mentioned Kenya, Peace Corps come into.
I was working here and I was in a job that I was the director of the Center for Women Veterans Health at the VA here, and it was miserable. People know things about the VA, just very rigid. It was really difficult to innovate in that environment, to, you know, bring new ideas and get people to want to make any change. And three of my friends had joined Peace Corps as Peace Corps medical officers. And so it's a job, not a volunteer, but as a job. And they were like, you know, you're perfect for this job. You should really think about leaving the VA. I was like, really? When can I go? So I ended up leaving the VA and I went to Malawi, and we lived in Malawi for almost 3 years, and then I became a rover for the Peace Corps. And then as a rover, I went to the Dominican Republic and Zambia and Guatemala and other places. And then the pandemic happened and everybody got, you know, we evacuated all of our volunteers from all over the world and they came back to the US. And one of my former students who founded an organization in Burundi said, we're looking for somebody to help us to transition from a cottage, a 30-bed hospital, into a 150-bed tertiary care hospital. And we wonder if you would be willing to help us to do that. And so that's what I did for the last three years, was to do that. And now the hospital is open, and we've recruited African physicians from all over the world. And I worked myself out of a job, in a good way.
So what's, like, a week in your life right now?
Oh, gosh. A week in my life. That's a great question. So a week in my life right now is exercising, working in the garden at least three or four at least 3 to 4 hours a day.
If not at home, you're here.
If not home, then here. Doing some volunteer work with the Master Gardeners Plant Propagation and Jenkins Estate and the Oregon Food Bank. They have a production garden for the food. I still have a few. I've been doing some personal coaching with people over the last 7 or 8 years. Mostly it's expats, people who are in transition, coming back into the U.S. who are just struggling with their reintegration. And so spending time talking with those folks and trying to just ease their path in, as they re-enter into the world that they're, a world that's so different than the world that they had lived in. We have a group of neighbors and friends, and we gather during the summer every week, but now we're transitioning to every other week. We have a big willow tree in my backyard, and we call it Willow Wednesday. And so we come together, it's a potluck, and we come together and we eat and talk and share and do those things. I come to church on Sundays. Yeah. And so, I have a full life.
And Moses.
And then there's Moses. On top of all of that, there's Moses. Yeah. So trying phone calls and trying to support him
Well, do you see the next years ahead? Do you see how God's moving you? Do you see kind of continuing on the path you're on?
I have no idea what's going to happen. I think that the best thing that we can really do is to live in the moment in which we're living in, live in the now. And, whether you're, reading the Bible or reading Ram Dass, it's be here now. So be here now in the moment that you're living in, and wait for that door to open, because it will open. There is something that is going to show up. And I think for me at this point, part of what's happening in terms of the future is just being more discriminating about what it is that I do say yes to. Because as I get older, I have, my interests are different, my energy is different, my desire to be engaged in some things is different, my desire to have time for quiet and reflection is growing. So I think I just want to sit with those things, and something will show up, use the energy that the energy of spirit will motivate me to say something like, oh, we really need to do something with that garden out there, Phil. We need to do something with that garden. That's a perfect garden. Shouldn't we do something? That motivates you to see something that is a potential.
And then
commit to being able to do it.
Yeah. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Really appreciate you.
Thank you, everybody.
Time. Does anybody have any question? We've got a few moments. Yes.
No, but I have a picture of her. I have to bring you one. I'll show you a picture of Aunt Ritha. When I met Ritha, I was like, where did you get that name? I've never met anybody who wasn't black who had a name with Ritha.
I'm sure we could spend a lot more time. Any other questions? Anybody? Yes.
Oh, my gosh, Doc Toddy. What kind of question is that? There's a couple, there's probably two patients that I'm going to think of at Lugulu in particular. One was a man who had gotten cut with a panga, with a machete, and he had never had a tetanus shot. And so he came and he had tetanus. And of course we didn't have tetanus toxoid or any of those things. And so the treatment is just to try to keep that person hydrated and nutritional to see if they'll survive the infection. And so we were like, you know, you get all of this jerking and twitching of the muscles because of the nervous system, and so we were constantly putting, like, we had replaces IV, like, you know, every 5, 6, 7, 8 hours we were replacing his IV, putting NG tubes down because he couldn't eat, he couldn't coordinate any of those things. And I mean, I was there with two other medical students from the US, and, you know, and the nurses, and we basically were just like around the clock, just trying to do everything that we could, talk to him, try to calm him down, pray over him, you know, do everything that we could to save his life. And we didn't, but we tried. So that's probably, and then another one would be in Kawangware, which is one of the slums in Nairobi. There is a woman who came in, and she was in labor, and I was there with a group of students, and we went off to do something else, and the woman who ran the clinic called and said, you know, can you come back? I really need help. And so it was this woman who was delivering, and she had just a bad position of the head, and it really required a different level of skill than the people who were there, but there was no way to move her and all of those other things. So I did end up delivering the baby, but the baby died. And she was so grateful because we had given her this wonderful, loving attention. Even though her baby had died, she was alive, and she was like, I could have another child, but I still have my life, and I am grateful for the love that you demonstrated to me. And that was just incredibly moving. Yes?
If Kamala were to appoint you as Secretary of the VA, do you think you could make some changes?
Oh, gosh. That's just such a huge question. I would love to be on somebody's like advisory board talking about. I wouldn't want to be in charge of something like that. It's just too huge. First of all, I don't think one person can really do that. But I would be happy to be on an advisory board that spoke to what our veterans deserve. You know, my grandfather was a veteran of the Spanish-American War. My father was a veteran of World War II. He went to school at Tuskegee. So so many military people in my family. My dad's, you know, really his final years of treatment were at the VA in Long Beach. And so, you know, I just feel like we could do so much of a better job, and but we need to have a different way of thinking. And so, yeah, I would be happy to give my two cents.
Maybe somebody can work on that.
Yeah, you gonna work on that for me, Rob? Great.
Well, thank you, Teresa.
Thank you.
You know, what resonates with me today, what challenges me, what inspires me, what moves me, motivates me, what might I receive from Teresa's story that I might incorporate, integrate into my own journey, and how might I be moved then toward love and more fully toward love and good deeds. And so, Chris, I'm going to invite you to come back up, and if you would stand, we're right at the 11 o'clock hour here. So thank you, Teresa, for the conversation.
Thank you
so much.